Okay, I'm recording.
Okay, it says I am as well.
See that?
Do you have to take a sip of water?
I'm actually still on coffee, man. I'm on my first cup. I'm going to be sipping all through this. I mean, we're recording this damn thing at the ass crack of yesterday, okay? I'm going to have my coffee. I'm not a morning person.
I did that 3 hours ago. So 4 hours ago. Okay.
Okay.
All right, so basically, I gotta stop doing that. Let's assume people have had like more important things to think about over the past 8 months than what's been going on with the movie theaters. Mm-hmm. But it's what's going on there is obviously having a big impact on what they're doing for entertainment. And it's happening at a time when people are desperate to be entertained. And both of you have been writing a lot about how this has been playing out. I mean, we sort of, when it first started happening, just said, you know, what the hell's going on here? And then it's taken on its whole arc. Since then, so I thought it would be good to bring everybody up to speed. I mean, going back to, it was like March when this first started to kick in, right? And it was when they had all those theatrical releases like Invisible Man, everything they dumped on the market. That was the first move, wasn't it?
I don't know. It's hard to keep it all sorted out. I think the first big move that I remember was Universal saying Fast and Furious 9, we're just moving it back a year. And then I think the dominoes started to fall in that time frame, but I don't remember which was first.
I think it was actually James Bond was the first. I think that was supposed to be the first film that was gonna release. And then because they actually had a premiere or something, and then they went ahead, like they had spent a bunch of money already to promote the date, and then they just went ahead and pushed it all the way to Christmas, which you know we know now is not going to happen. But I kind of think that Bond might have been the first movie to say, "Whoa, we're going to move back on this." But it's like, Dennis, it's been so long ago and so much has happened.
7 years ago, man.
Yeah, I know. 10 lifetimes have passed.
I don't want to make too many assumptions. Let's remind people what the initial trigger was for all this. I mean, why we're talking about this. When did the Onward thing happen?
Siaka reviewed Onward on March 23rd.
And that happened like super quick. Yeah. Like it was supposed to come out. I can't remember exactly what, I mean.
Well, it did come out. It came out theatrically on March 6th.
That's right. It came out. And then like within 2 weeks, Disney had said, boom, we're going to put it out for free on Disney Plus.
Well, they said first we're going to do VOD.
That's right.
And then like 2 weeks later, Disney Plus. Yeah,
that's right. But that, I mean, they made that decision really quickly. And I think that for some of the films, because they had gone out in the theater, the decision was, I think, easier to make. Bloodshot was another one. I'm trying to think some of the ones around that same time, because they had, I mean, the genie was out of the bottle. The film had been released and then the cinemas were all closing. So then you had this decision of, okay, do we unrelease it or do we find an alternative way to release it? And I think that it also at that point became a huge opportunity to make to experiment. If you know, if we do put it out, you know, what's that going to look like and what kind of revenue could that bring in? What would people be willing to pay if we're going to charge for it? And I think also for Disney, it was an easy decision that, hey, look, this is a marquee title that we can drive people to Disney Plus. But those first batch of films were a little bit easier because they had already been in the theater when all the theaters were closing. And then it was like, okay, you know, do we just leave this thing in, you know, theatrical purgatory for X amount of time, or do we move forward and do something else with it?
And I think they also knew they could earn a lot of goodwill by putting kids' movies into the hands of parents who were now having to live at home with their children 24 hours a day and didn't know what to do with them, you know? So hence Frozen hitting Disney Plus, you know, Onward hitting it within a couple of weeks, things like that. So I think overall, it's funny. If you look at Disney's overall strategy in terms of their content, a lot of the more adult oriented stuff, they're still holding in their pocket. You know, I mean, Black Widow has been pushed back again and again and again and again, but like, you know, Frozen 2, bam, Disney Plus, Onward, VOD for a bit, then Disney Plus. The next Pixar film, you know, Soul. Boom, Disney Plus on Christmas Day. So it seems to me that they've treated children's content differently than they've treated adult content.
Well, again, they, you know, the big outlier in that is Hamilton, which they
was supposed to come out October of next year.
Yeah, I mean, and would have made you got to imagine hundreds of millions of dollars had they kept it. But I think that the streaming world has changed everything. You know, we need content out there. We need new content out there. Nothing's in the pipeline, really. What do we have that we can do? And, you know, how much is it worth for us to put it out there?
I just wanted to go back to the chronology for 1 second. The PVOD stuff and premium video on demand and the Onward thing happened pretty much simultaneously, right? In March? Because, John, you wrote that one piece that talked about both around that time.
Yeah, I feel that it was. I'm looking now. I had a post called Hollywood Dives Deep into Day and Date that was on March 20th. And I think that's when Universal had their, what they were calling it, theater at home or home premiere of Emma, The Invisible Man, and The Hunt. And that's right around the same time that I feel like Pixar announced that they were going to make Onward available for premium video on demand, which, you know, pay, which, yeah, if I'm looking at the timeline here, it would have been right around that same March 20th date. So it was Universal and Disney all had those movies all around the same time. And then, you know, Bloodshot and I can't remember what the next batch of films were, also joined that as well.
Two things I want to say is, one is it ended up that the Disney track and the PVOD track ended up being sort of the guidepost for where this went, and there's been variations along the way. And one of the things I was wondering at the time, it's hard to know because everybody was just in triage. It seemed like one of the reasons why they made Onward so accessible and affordable was kind of a Trojan horse to get people used to this model. And we've since watched that evolve with the Mulan release and with what they're planning on doing with Soul now. Does that seem like a fair surmise? Because it seemed weird that they took that film and you just bought it and you can watch it an infinite number of times instead of them hitting you every time you wanted to rent it.
Well, Onward, as Dennis mentioned, it had kind of a two-stage release. I mean, initially, it was available from digital retailers like Kaleidoscape and Apple TV and Vudu for a pay. And then I believe it was 2 weeks later, it was for free on Disney Plus.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was basically, the experiment is how many people are going to buy it versus how many of our subscribers are going to wait 2 weeks to watch it for free. Mm-hmm. You know, Mulan, they took a different tack. Well,
that's why I'm thinking that the Disney Plus aspect of it was get people used to first run stuff on Disney Plus, then let's see what we can do to up the ante, which is what they did with Mulan.
And then, but you know, they said from the beginning that Mulan was a one-off experiment. I mean, that they were upfront with about that from the time of the announcement. We're just trying this. We're going to see how it works. This is not our plan going forward. It's a one-off thing. So,
but if they're trying to see how it works, it means they could be considering it, implementing it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Dennis, do you think that Soul is not a premium pay title like Mulan because it's a kid's title?
I think so.
Yeah.
That's what I think. It seems to me that they are focused on getting the kids stuff into the Disney Plus pipeline, you know, just the subscription pipeline, not premium purchase or anything. And, you know, listen, I think it's smart. And the reason I think it's smart is because if a kid likes a movie, that kid is going to watch that movie a bazillion times. And, you know, for a parent to go, oh, Frozen 2 just came out or whatever just came out on Disney Plus, my kid's going to want to watch that until, you know, I die of old age. So I can get that for a subscription. And I think it's really motivation to go on and just subscribe to Disney Plus if they haven't already. So I think it's smart. You know, it's a little calculated, but I think it's smart.
I wanted to, God, this feels like ancient history. I wanted to briefly revisit the whole Tenet thing because that has probably had the biggest impact on everything we're going to talk about recently.
And I'm one of the 10 people that saw it.
John, why don't you recap how that played out?
Well, I'm going to not have the timeline accurate, but...
Broad strokes.
Tenet, I mean, for the longest time, Christopher Nolan said, you know, emphatically, it will get a theatrical release. And it was kind of held out there as that it was going to, this was going to be what was going to reopen movie theaters. This was going to be the return to cinema, the savior of, you know, the commercial cinema. But as, you know, restrictions stayed in place or increased and, you know, dates for the film just kept getting pushed and pushed and pushed, which for a movie of that nature, I mean, made it just impossible to market it. So finally, I think they just drew a line in the sand and said, it's coming out on X and such a date, and it's going to come out, even knowing that it was not going to show in the two major markets of New York and California. And it opened up in the States, but it had a, you know, pretty dismal opening. I think it was the number one movie in the country with, like, you know, sub $10 million its opening weekend, which it probably would have been a $200 million open normally, I mean, or $100 million. I mean, you know, it was a movie that would normally have made, you know, a ton. So I think that it showed, you know, again, the great experiment, it showed studios that even if you were to put things out there, people, even markets where theaters are open, people are not ready to go back yet. And that started the next wave of cancellations and pushbacks. So, I mean, Tenet, instead of, you know, wanting to be the savior of commercial cinema, it might have actually been, you know, another nail in its coffin, showing that, hey, look, people, it doesn't matter what content you put out there, people are not ready to come back and see it in any kind of, you know, serious numbers.
Yeah, my understanding is all of the chains were operating at a loss when they showed that film.
Yes.
Well, as I mentioned, I went and saw it. Our local, I can't even remember the theater chain, it had a thing where you could rent the whole movie theater out and have 20 people come in and watch it. And so I did that and had 20 of my friends come. And I think we were the only people in there. I mean, not just in our auditorium, but in the theater. I mean, there was nobody else that we saw in the concession stand. You know, it was like a ghost town. So you got to think beyond... You know, most theaters make their money on concessions, and with nobody going there, nobody buying anything, even if they were just getting people in the seats to see the movie, that's not enough to keep theaters in business.
Given what we're talking about, there's very little satisfaction in saying, I told you so, but would we all agree that the Tenet thing was pretty much doomed from the start?
I think it was, and here's the reason that I think it was. I think it was doomed because by that point, people had already learned, oh, well, if you want to release this for home viewing, you've proven that you can. You know, we've, you know, lived our whole lives debating how are we going to do day and date? Oh my God, it's going to require a $30,000 box and $5,000 rentals. And how in the world is this ever going to, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then the pandemic happens and Hollywood goes, yeah, we can just put it on Vudu for $20. Right. And people realized, oh, that's a thing. You could do that. And I think the fact that Warner and Nolan weren't so insistent upon not doing that, I think it turned a lot of people off. I think a lot of people were like, you know what, man, give it to me on Vudu or something, and I'll pay a premium price to see it right now. But the fact that they're not doing this almost seems to be a dangerous act of hubris. And I don't know if your average movie viewer could articulate it as such, but I think that background resentment was there. You've proven you don't have to go this route. So why are you going this route?
Yeah, I know this only matters to a certain segment, a rather large segment of the population, but there's something about the whole exercise that on the part of the studios, the movie theaters, and Nolan seems inherently insensitive. It's like, my movie is so important that I don't care if it endangers people. We're going to reopen these theaters, we're going to bring it out there, and we're going to prove everybody wrong by having this huge success. And it just never felt like it was going to go that way.
Yeah.
So anyways, Tenet sort of brings us up to the present moment. I mean, there's been other things that you know, we can go into, but recently both of you wrote about this thing with the Christie patent, which came up pretty much simultaneously with Disney talking about Soul and what happened behind the scenes with that. So, John, do you want to talk about the patent? And then, Dennis, you can tell me about your reaction to all that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Dennis is better to talk about the patent. He actually looked it up and read it. But, you know, Christie, they made an announcement that they had applied for a patent, I think it was 2 years ago, and they had just received it. I believe it was back in September. That they, as much as they, you know, blah, 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 feel the commercial experience is important, that they have a way to deliver content to the home market safely and securely, and letting the local cinema chain, you know, cutting them in to the revenue of this. The thing that I took away from it was that they decided to hold the announcement that they got the patent for over a month, which seems interesting. They were issued the patent on September 22nd, and then almost a month later, they announced that they had received the patent. And to me, it seems like there's something in there as to why they would just wait a month. And it almost feels like, hey, look, we don't want to continue piling on to, you know, our theatrical partners. But also, would this be good or bad for commercial cinemas? You know, if they were able to still be cut into a piece of the pie, is that piece big enough with the revenue sharing that it would actually benefit them? You know, if everybody decided to stay home and watch movies, even if they were streamed from your local Cineplex, and they got, I don't know, $1, $2 from every viewing, would that, you know, little bit be enough to keep them in business without the popcorn, without the Cokes, or would that just be another thing that's pushing them more toward extinction?
You know, my response to that may seem a little, I don't know, cynical or bitter or whatever you want to say it is. But I think if we were living in a world without so many streaming options, this might be more viable. I think, you know, in the past, the commercial cinema release schedule was way more important than it is now, you know? And I think maybe, I don't know, 5 years ago, if you had told people, oh, hey, you can dial into a stream for your local movie theater and, you know, it'll start at 7 o'clock or whatever, they would have been like, well, what's a stream? But okay, that sounds cool. But the reality is we've got so much content to watch now. There's so much stuff on Netflix. I mean, like, why is somebody sitting at home going to go, ooh, okay, I can buy this overpriced stream from my local movie theater, and it's going to start at 7:45 p.m. and I've got to be sitting on my couch right then and
with ready, trailers and ads.
Yeah, trailer ready to watch. And I just don't think that's the way we live anymore. I don't think that's the way we consume content. I think people, okay, yes, of course, if you're going to a location and sitting in a room with 300 people or whatever to watch a movie, yeah, it's got to start at a certain time. But, we've gotten to the point to where, like, even my dad is a cord cutter now. Even my dad, 78 years old, does not subscribe to cable because the notion of having to sit down at a specific time to watch something just seems archaic even to him, right? So yeah, I don't know. I it's not whether this is good or I just think it's irrelevant, to be honest with you. I think it's too little too late.
Could we agree that almost everything we're talking about here has just accelerated the inevitable, and that the way things are playing out are actually really beneficial and is just speeding up that whole process?
Well, beneficial unless you're a cinema chain owner.
Well, that's the thing. I think it's, I was thinking about it 9 months ago. The Christie thing would have been big news, even though we soon would have found out it's irrelevant. Also, the Justice Department getting that law struck down about studios owning theater chains would have been a big deal. Now you can't get anybody to snatch them up at fire sale prices. So, you know, could we agree that except for some dumb, you know, some, you know, going through the motions, movie theaters may be as dead as vaudeville at this point?
I think they're going to have a really hard time coming back from this because, you know, people are creatures of habit. And when a habit changes, it's hard to get people back out of that habit. And like Dennis just said, people are now not in the habit of having to do things on a restricted schedule. I think that there will always be those big event things where people want to get together and watch them, but are there enough of those that would be able to, you know, justify the theater's existence. But I also wonder too, the flip side of that coin, let's just say that the commercial experience, maybe it doesn't go away completely, but it's greatly diminished. I would think that that would have an impact on the types of films that studios choose to make. And, you know, these big $200 million tentpoles might be a thing of the past because they would just be too risky.
Well, one thing I'll throw into the mix, and this is something else that got accelerated, you know, this has obviously forced people to figure out how they want to experience entertainment at home. And without being able to go into theaters, consciously or unconsciously, they're trying to create more of a theater type experience. And we're at a point where 75-inch TVs, really good quality ones, are becoming really affordable. And the technology of soundbars has really improved, so that the transition away from theaters is being accelerated by that as well. And you've got people with pretty massive screens. So I think you can have blockbuster type films feel way more satisfying at home than they used to for a much broader part of the market.
Well, I mean, go ahead, Siaka.
I don't disagree that the experience can be fantastic, but I just don't know that a studio would gamble with a $200 million title if it was going to go straight to home. How many people are going to be willing to pay $20 for that? I mean, I don't know that we've seen any of the numbers on, you know, the Invisible Mans, the Emmas, the Hunts, the Bloodshots. You know, Disney's saying that Mulan was successful, but I don't know that they're announcing any figures to that. I'm just saying, if the model wasn't where you're getting millions of people to go out on, you know, opening weekend and pay $10 plus to see it, would they still make these giant movies? Even though the experience could be fantastic at home and all that, are there enough people at home who have access to, you know, tens of thousands of different things for free on a streaming service they're already subscribing to? Would they pay a premium to that? Would enough of them do it that would make it worthwhile for these giant investments in films?
I think there is a need for event films occasionally. I think they're always being, we'll find a way to reinvent. We always find a way to make that happen. And as technology changes and the viewing circumstances keep evolving. So I don't see that going away. I just think it's going to take on a radically different form.
I think you're right. And I think you're onto something here. What I was going to say is, look at what Disney is doing with some of its quote unquote television content. Now, The Mandalorian looks like a, you know, $250 million film over the course of, you know, however many episodes. And the truth of the matter is they realized really quickly, well, we can't spend $250 million on this, but we want it to look like we did. So how are we going to do that? And Jon Favreau really worked with ILM and dove in and developed his virtual sets technology. So you could do that kind of look on a much cheaper budget. Well, we're starting to see feature films, blockbuster feature films, start to use that virtual set technology. And so now a movie that would have cost $250 million, maybe it's only going to cost $150 million or something like that. So I think we're seeing this weird thing where you can't spend $250 million on a season of a television show, but people have expectations in terms of the effects. So they're innovating so they can do it cheaper. Now those innovations are being used on to bring down the budget of big blockbuster films. So I think you could do a movie now that looks like Avengers Endgame for a lot less than it costs to make Avengers Endgame. And that's because of innovations developed by Disney for its television content. You know, if you look at Falcon and Winter Soldier, if you look at WandaVision, these are two of the big, you know, Marvel Cinematic Universe television shows that are coming out on Disney Plus. They look like they were shot on a bazillion-dollar budget, and they weren't. So I don't know. I think talking about numbers is kind of irrelevant at this point, just because the technology is evolving so fast. I think we're going to still see movies that look like that. I just don't think they're going to cost $250 million to make. So.
Well, I think, I mean, again, we keep mentioning Disney. I mean, Disney is the outlier here, because they're really the only one that has their own, you know, distribution scheme through Disney Plus.
And well, I don't, Warner I don't, does now too.
Well, Warner, yeah, I mean, Are you air quoting that?
Well, no,
I know, but I they do, but I mean, it's so much smaller. But I mean, I think for Disney, part of the investment in Mandalorian is are they up to 100 million subscribers now? I mean, Disney Plus?
I don't know. I haven't looked lately.
What I mean, it's some huge number. When you figure out, it's like, okay, we're bringing in, let's just say $500 million a month in recurring revenue that we need to continue keeping all these people happy with content. It you can invest in a giant thing and put it out there, like, you know, Soul. I mean, what an added bonus. I mean, I don't, you know, what is it, $100 million to make a Pixar movie? Less the marketing. So now it's like, okay, you know, this movie might have made $1 billion theatrically, but we're making $500 million a month. Let's keep these people happy. And I don't know that, you know, what is a Universal going to do with a giant blockbuster release?
Well, Disney sort of learned that from Netflix, because yeah, Netflix uses their subscriber pool to fund various projects. And it's not as contingent on one or the other big project anymore.
No, but if I'm not mistaken, I think Netflix is still operating at a loss.
I'm not denying that Disney's doing it better. I'm just saying that. I think that's what the
Netflix to me is just a pyramid scheme of, you know, bringing in new money to cover old money. But the other thing I was going to say too, that is really interesting to me, I'm sure you guys saw it. The rumor is that their United Artists is now, or MGM, is shopping out Bond, and they apparently shopped it to Netflix and Apple TV. The numbers that are being bandied about are like 500 and 600 million, and both of those companies said no, it's not worth it. So I think that
things have changed.
Yeah, things have changed, and it's like, you know, another thing, like with Netflix, they're willing to cut content that they don't feel is worth it to them. You know, they had a 10-part series Away that was very highly rated, but I think they said that it was 5 to 6 million an episode to make it, and they said to them it just wasn't worth it to do. So I think that everybody's learning here, what's the investment worth, what's the payback worth, you know, how, and ultimately it's probably how little can I do to keep these subscribers happy.
This sort of brings it to the point where I wanted to pull Dennis in. You know, still talking about Disney, you know, explain what happened with Soul, the same time that Soul was being announced, the stuff that was going on behind the scenes at Disney.
Well, you know, I think the most fascinating thing is that Disney announced they've basically restructured their organization strictly for the purposes of the fact that their direction now, their commitment is to streaming as the future of cinema. And I, you know, it's one thing to say that. It's another thing to literally restructure your organization around that goal. And so, yeah, I think that's the thing that kind of changes everything. When you've got a juggernaut like that going, yeah, that's cute, movie theaters and all, but we think the future's Disney Plus. That would seem like big talk if they weren't literally restructuring to do it. So,
and that's particularly dramatic because they're the one studio that knows how to put out event movies, mm-hmm. and do tentpoles and make $1 billion off from a film. And they're saying even we don't have a lot of confidence in that model anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think the thing with Mulan is probably the thing that changed for them. I think I heard something like Mulan made $251 million in its first month on Disney Plus, and they didn't have to revenue share that with anybody.
Well, and the other thing is, look at the minimal overhead as well. Mm-hmm. They're not sending files around, they're not having to deal with distribution chain and dealing with print advertising or any of the other stuff they have to do when they get stuff out in the theaters.
Yeah, and they're not taking an automatic 50% cut of revenues day one. So, yeah. And let's keep in mind, Disney Plus is still not available everywhere. So that's not a worldwide total. That's just, you know, sort of what they made off the markets where Disney Plus exists.
I don't want this to run so long that I never get around to editing it. Mm-hmm. So there are two other things I want to cover. But one, is there anything else as far as just bringing us up to date on what's going on with releases or with the studios that we should mention before I segue?
Can I throw something silly out there?
Okay.
I was thinking the other day about Bill and Ted, of all things. You're going to laugh at me, but this came this came to me in a dream. I dreamed we lived in a world where there was no pandemic. I have no idea why I dreamed this, by the way. I must have eaten something weird, but I dreamed we live in a world where there was no pandemic. And, you know, oh, hey, there's a new Bill and Ted movie coming out in the theaters. And people went, oh, that's cool. Hey, I remember Bill and Ted. That was cool. And then, yeah, but am I really going to go to the movies and see that? No, I'm not going to go to the movies and see that. I'll wait for it to come off on video. And then it bombed the theaters. And then by the time it did come out in on video, people were like, oh, yeah, I heard that movie stunk. It bombed at the theaters. And so it had no life. So this whole premium video on demand thing, I don't know. I think you can envision a scenario in which it saved a movie like Bill and Ted because it was available immediately day one on premium video on demand. All the people who had nostalgia for it bought it, you know, and it was a pretty big success. Do I think that film would have been as successful had it hit movie theaters as its primary first distribution point? Well, at least in my dreams, I don't think so.
Let me ask a really ignorant question. So there were no reviews out when that film hit, right? Mm-mm. So there's nothing to alter people's perceptions of it.
Yeah.
So studios have got to love that for as long as that until somebody finds a way to game that. Yeah. That's great for them.
Yeah.
I would have never seen Bill and Ted in the theater. I mean, that would have been one of those things. We'll wait till Netflix has got it and we'll rent and, you know, we'll get a disc or whatever.
Yeah.
But that, you know, that there was no new content out and I could watch it at home. You know, it was a heck, why not? You know, whatever it was, $29 or whatever. So yeah, I think for some movies like B-rate titles, it gets an audience that it maybe wouldn't have been able to get.
Okay, this is one of the two things I want to segue to. This is like a pet theory of mine, and I just want to see. My thinking is for these films that they're hanging on to, especially if ones they're hanging on to for a year or more, it's obvious just on the level of what's going on with movie theaters and entertainment that we're living in a different world now. And socially, we're living in a different world. We've been through so many things in the past few months that didn't even pertain when these films were made. I'm concerned that when the majority of these are finally released, they're going to feel out of touch. They're going to feel antiquated. And people are going to be looking for other types of entertainment that, like the Netflixes of the world, with shorter production times, will be able to address. So, you know, I could be utterly wrong about this, but I think it's another thing where the dinosaur-type studios may be digging their own graves.
I'm kind of worried about that with the new Batman movie. When you originally said that to me on the phone, Mike, that was the first thing I thought of as Batman, because Batman has always been a character that is about right now. Every new interpretation or iteration of Batman is about the present moment. They're making a movie now that's not coming out until 2022. It's either not going to be an effective Batman movie or it's going to seem to be an incredibly dated Batman movie. So...
Well, and I think some of that, I was going to say some of that too, Mike. I think we're like, I think Tenet was maybe not the right movie to come out right then. I don't know that people, there's enough heaviness going on in the world right now. I don't know that they needed another really heavy.
I think they needed a break.
Yeah.
I think there's been too much emphasis on intensity.
Yeah. In movies. And I think, you know, that movie, you know, had it been a light comedy or a fantasy or something, I think it might have done better. I think it was almost like, I just can't take this right now.
I also think part of what hurt Tenet was just the amount of weight that it was given. This is the most important thing in the world. This movie's going to change everything. It's either going to save theaters or going to kill them. And I think people went, you know, kind of, I think maybe my rent's a little more important right now. And I think just the outsized and vastly overstated importance of the release of that film hurt it.
Yeah, I do think it was kind of crushed under its own weight for sure.
Nothing is that important. No movie is that important. I'm sorry.
But we've needed that course correction for a while.
Yeah.
You know, this idea of omnipotent directors is absurd. last thing, which is only tangentially related to this, but I wanted to is, you know, now that I've had a straddle for a couple months now and I've been able to wade through a lot of titles, I'm getting to see a lot of catalog stuff that's being upgraded to, you know, HDR. Mm-hmm. And it definitely separates the men from the boys. I mean, there's some films that just don't hold up at all. And there's other films that look extraordinary. So one, I wanted to see what your experiences have been with that. And two, I wanted to see what you think have been the best 4K HDR releases of catalog titles to date.
I think my two favorites are probably The Wizard of Oz and Beetlejuice. I think for the first time at home, we can see the richness and nuance of the color palettes in those two films. It just simply wasn't possible with 8-bit color. You know, we can see the boosted, heightened primary colors, but also the more muted and subdued pastels that exist in the color palettes of those films. And, you know, when you're doing an 8-bit transfer, I'm sorry, like if you're doing a DVD or a Blu-ray or something like that, you have to choose, is everything cranked or is everything muted? And HDR gives the color timing, the room to say, no, you can have both in the same frame. So those two for me are probably the best.
Well, probably just from its recentness. I mean, Spartacus, I had never seen it before, but it to think that it's a movie that's 65 years old, how well maintained that it could be and the care that they took to just make it look fantastic. That's one that I definitely think that people should check out the new release. It's probably never looked that good unless you saw it, in some fantastic cinema, back in whenever it came out, 60. I'm trying to think of anything else that really stands out from the older movies. That one is so fresh in my mind, but it is great to see that they're going back to the catalog on these titles and making them look so fresh again. And, generally they're doing it with not a very heavy hand. I mean, they're not trying to make look like a movie that was shot last week. They're keeping it true to the way that it looked, but just taking away layers of, years of, sitting in a vault somewhere, and then giving, some highlights that we never saw and some lowlights that we never could appreciate with the HDR. I think it's great. And I think it's also great because a lot of people now that do collect movies, have systems that can appreciate this and they're going back. It's giving them a chance to enjoy something again. And it's also giving studios another revenue stream, which they desperately need right now.
But something else we can thank the crisis for like accelerating this.
Mike, I know you've been taking quite the roller coaster ride through the Hitchcock catalog recently.
Yeah, I mean, I just watched Vertigo over the weekend, and it's stunning. And this is on the heels of watching Rear Window and The Birds, which, I'll be honest, they look terrible. And it's what they have to work with, and I get that, but I don't think Hitchcock is well served by having those other titles out there yet. I think they should have taken more time and found a better way to present them. Especially once you look at them against Vertigo, you realize, hey, maybe he did know what he was doing as a filmmaker.
Yeah.
Because The Birds, all the process shots and everything, the mismatching, it all looks like it was cut together with scissors and it feels random. And Rear Window is just softness and grain and all this other stuff throughout. And yep, none of that is in Vertigo, which I realize Robert Harris did a restoration on. Mm-hmm. But it just exists on a whole other plane.
And the thing is, he could do a restoration because the elements existed.
Yeah.
Hitch was just not very careful with a lot of his elements, just sort of willy-nilly threw them out or lost them or whatever.
It's a tough call, but if you're trying to get people excited about older films in HDR, do you really want them starting with something like Rear Window, which is probably his most famous film, mm-hmm. and having it look like that? And then they're saying, is there really a benefit here?
I think, again, if you compared it to what had been available, it's still generally a huge leap forward. But, the danger in all of this added resolution and clarity is that sometimes you see things that you didn't see, when it came out. And, I mentioned in my review of Spartacus, you really notice that every time can't remember her name right now, the female character is on the screen, she looks noticeably defocused. Compared to, and that was certainly the filming strategy of the time, and you can't fix that after the fact. Or if you could, it would, you know, certainly ruin the look of it or the intent. Yeah, but
you can't retroactively remove Vaseline from a lens.
Yeah. And so I think that, you know, back in the day, you know, you wouldn't have noticed that as much, but now when you're watching it, you know, with 8 million pixels on a, you know, 100+ inch screen, some of those things stand out more to you. And it's, you know, not a flaw of the restoration, not a flaw of the filmmaking. It's just, you know, a product of what they had to work with.
Yeah. I don't know the first thing about what I'm talking about here, but Gerard Alessandrini and I have been talking about this a lot. You know, the production designers and cinematographers knew how to compensate for this stuff when they originally shot it. It just didn't look that fake in the theater. And I've seen a lot of these films in the theaters, and they're convincing. It's something, I don't know if it's the brightness coupled with the resolution or something, or the intensity of it, that just makes fake things look more fake, like photo backdrops.
Conversely, like with The Wizard of Oz, though, for my entire life, you know, the scene in the throne room when there's that long hallway that recedes, you know, supposedly into infinity, that has always just looked like a painting, like a backdrop. But in the HDR grade of the film, there are more steps of gray to be able to define the shadows that they painted in that backdrop. And for the first time in my life, it actually convincingly kind of looks like a hallway receding into infinity instead of just a wall that somebody painted. So the HDR giveth and the HDR taketh away, you know?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It depends on how you do it. Depends on what you do when you get that film scanned into the computer and start, you know, choosing the value scale for it. So
yeah, the last thing I was going to say is the one thing I've seen to date that bordered on perfect was The Shining, because I know that film intimately, frame by frame, and except for two very minor things that I mentioned in the review, I felt like it was absolutely true to the film. It enhanced it. It made it felt like something projected in the theater in the best possible circumstances. And, you know, there's more film, you know, there's more transfers that can honor that, then I think we're in for a really good time. Mm-hmm. John, any closing thoughts?
Not really. I mean, I think it goes back to the care that studios took to some properties versus others.
Yeah.
And, you know, they can only make it look as good as what they have to work with. And to me, Spartacus is just an obvious example. The Wizard of Oz, obviously, as well, too. I mean, those are both very old, but treasured properties, and they've kept them in great condition. And also, I mean, it's far more recently, but to me, the way that Empire Strikes Back looks is, I mean, just spectacular. I mean, it looks like a movie that could have been shot recently. It sounds great. It looks great. And I think, again, you know, Lucas knew how to take care of those properties. And I hopefully they'll continue finding these, you know, archival elements that are great, and we'll get a bunch of new releases, hopefully starting with The Abyss, which I would love to see on 4K HDR.
Dennis?
I don't think I really have anything to add. I mean, I think we've pretty well covered it. Although the one thing I will say is that I've always had an appreciation for older films. I mean, you know, Mike, Wizard of Oz is my favorite film of all time. But I just simply, in this pandemic, find myself watching more of them. And I don't know if it's a comfort thing, or if it is a quality thing, or just a nostalgia thing. I don't know. I just find myself watching films that I've watched dozens of times already instead of any number of new things that I really, really, really want to watch. I just somehow don't make the time.
Yeah. Good. It's like I said, this has been a god-awful year, but there's been some upside to it, some benefits, and they almost all have to do with entertainment. So we're kind of, it's nice we have our little desert island. Mm-hmm. Does that sound terrible or no?
No, I mean, you know, I think you may be catching some of my optimism. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah.
We've got to find our bright spots in this darkness. And I begrudge no one for trying to do that.
So. I don't want to open up a can of worms, but, you know, going to a movie theater hasn't been a big experience since the mid-50s. And, you know, going to the movies has sort of been dying out thanks to streaming and everything else. And if we've accelerated that, if we found ways to make streaming better, if people are getting better, bigger screens, and if the variety of the content improves, and we get these older titles revitalized, that's all good stuff.
Well, I'll leave you with this anecdote. My buddy Matt, who is one of my pod people, I can't believe we're calling them that. He's in my quarantine circle. He came over last week, and you know, we hang out quite a bit, but we've never really watched a movie together at my house. And we sit down and we watch a movie. And it was as it was over, he looked at me and he was like, "Why have we been going to IMAX all these years?" I was like, I don't know. I thought you wanted to." And he was like, "Yeah, that was so much better than a movie theater." I think new people are getting exposed to that all the time. Yeah. I know anecdote is not the singular form of data, but more and more people are reaching out to me over the internet going, "What display do I need? Should I get a receiver? Should I get a surround sound processor? What speakers should I get? Should I do in wall? Should I do in room? Should I do in ceiling?" I'm getting more normies coming to me for home theater advice than I have in my entire 2-decade career.
Yeah, all good stuff. I thought that went well.
I think so too. Sorry about all the dropouts.
No, well, thankfully you're recording on a parallel track, so it's not like we lost them.
So. That's true. That's true.
That's good. The other thing I was going to say, thank you for all the writing that allowed us to have this conversation. And I think the one thing we can say for certain is the next 6 months will be just as interesting.
Maybe even more so, honestly.
Well, that sounds a little too much like a Chinese curse from my girlfriend.
Well, let's end that positive note and just focus on it. So maybe we'll try this again.